Hello, and welcome to the Illinois Audio Reader. My name is Cedric Richardson, and today I'll be bringing you part two of the Decatur Herald Review. Thank you for joining me. Our first story is national news. It's a coronavirus update as the United States signs a contract with Pfizer for 100 million vaccine doses. Here's the latest. Health and Human Services Secretary Alex Azar announced Wednesday that the United States has signed a contract with Pfizer for delivery in December of the first 100 million doses of a COVID-19 vaccine the pharmaceutical company is working to develop. The United States could buy another 500 million doses under the agreement, said Azar. Now, those would, of course, have to be safe and effective and be approved by the Food and Drug Administration, Azar said during an appearance on Fox News. Pfizer Incorporated and BioNTech SE announced separately that the agreement is with HHS and the Defense Department for a vaccine candidate the companies are developing jointly. Here's an update on all developments. At least 1,000 American deaths are linked to the coronavirus and were reported on Tuesday, and the spread shows no sign of slowing down. The harrowing death toll comes as states across the country report record-breaking numbers of new cases. The United States said Wednesday it has ordered China to close its consulate in Houston to protect American intellectual property and the private information of Americans. President Donald Trump warned on Tuesday that the nasty, horrible coronavirus will get worse in the U.S. before it gets better. But he also tried to paint a rosy picture of efforts to conquer the disease that has claimed more than 140,000 American lives in just 5 months. The price tag for the next COVID-19 aid package could quickly swell above the $1 trillion as White House officials negotiate with Congress over money to reopen schools, prop up small businesses, boost virus testing, and keep cash flowing to Americans while the virus crisis deepens. As workers return to offices, children prepare to return to schools, and those desperate for normalcy again visit malls and restaurants, the emerging science points to a menacing reality. If people who appear healthy can transmit the illness, it may be impossible to contain. A new snapshot of the frantic global response to the coronavirus pandemic shows some of the world's largest government donors of humanitarian aid are buckling under this strain. Funding commitments for the virus and otherwise have dropped by a third from the same period last year. The World Health Organization and the Africa Centers for Disease Control and Prevention have launched an effort to explore the role of traditional medicine in the coronavirus pandemic. In local court news, the defense is to rest Wednesday in a murder trial for the Decatur man accused in a Bloomington death. Closing arguments are expected to begin Wednesday afternoon in the murder trial for a Decatur man charged in the shooting death of a Bloomington man. Anthony Gramsas, 20, is one of three Decatur men believed to be involved in the December 5th 2018 death of Egerton Dover of Bloomington. He is charged with first-degree murder, home invasion, and robbery. His co-defendant, Taiwan Bruce, 21, also faces murder charges under legal accountability laws that allow a person to be charged if the death occurred during the commission of a forcible felony. A third person allegedly involved in the homicide, 18-year-old Curtis Harrison, died during a 2019 shooting inside a Decatur restaurant. Gramsa's attorney Steve Skelton called four witnesses after the state rested its case Tuesday. An additional defense witness could be called on Wednesday, followed by at least one witness for the state's rebuttal before closing arguments. Judge Scott Drzewski denied the admission of a third-party witness's testimony as part of the defense's evidence because the judge says it did not fulfill the criteria for hearsay exceptions. The denied testimony, which was heard while the jury was out of the courtroom, was from a normal man who said he knew Gramsa's, Bruce, and Hairston. He told the court Hairston admitted to shooting Dover while they were at a New Year's Eve party. The witness said Hairston and Bruce explained to him that they intended to rob Dover of his cannabis, but Gramsis was not with them when they went into the victim's house. He said Hairston said he pulled the gun and shot Dover after they wrestled for the weapon. "And then they go get Gramsis," Skelton said, reading from a transcript of the witness's interview with police. According to the bill of indictment, Gramsa's two counts of first-degree murder are forcible felonies involving home invasion and robbery, respectively. This indicates Gramsa is accused of committing the crime of home invasion, which caused Dover's death, and the crime of robbery, which caused the death. Gramsa's mother, Molly Gramsa, was barred from the courtroom after she spoke aloud while Drzewski made his ruling on the admissibility of the testimony as evidence. "Wow, I'm just shocked," she said to the judge before leaving. Driver in a fatal crash that killed a pregnant Decatur woman was going 60 to 70 miles per hour. A coroner's jury on Wednesday ruled six deaths as homicide, one involving a gunshot wound and the others stemming from crashes that authorities say involved impaired drivers. Jamila Cunningham, 27, was the passenger in a car on May 25th when it was struck by another vehicle on North Jasper and East Condit Streets. Her mother, Alicia Hull, testified Cunningham was 4 months pregnant at the time of her death. Authorities say the driver of the other vehicle, Malik O. Lewis, 23, fled the scene on foot. He was arrested on preliminary charges of causing an accident that resulted in injury and death and failing to report an accident involving a death. All preliminary charges are subject to review by the state's attorney's office. Decatur Police Officer Christopher Cohn said witnesses and forensic evidence the night of the crash led investigators to believe Cunningham's car was traveling between 60 and 70 miles per hour in a 35 mile per hour zone at the time of the crash. Coroner's juries are used to determine whether a death is natural, accidental, suicide, homicide, or undetermined. Coroner's jury rulings have no bearing on a criminal case. In another case involving a fleeing driver heard Wednesday, four passengers died in a vehicle collision on June 1st. Armani Cooper, 23, Keithisha Bowman, 20, Brittany King, 19, and Shonez Harper, 23, all of Decatur, were passengers in the same car around 2:43 a.m., authorities say the driver ran a red light at East Grand Avenue and North Water Street and was hit by a semi-truck. Decatur Police Officer Craig Lundy said the driver was tested and found to have a blood alcohol content of 0.25. 0.08 is the legal limit for impairment in Illinois, and 14.5 nanograms of cannabis. Lindy said the semi-truck driver was not charged or ticketed since he had the right-of-way and was not speeding at the time of the crash. Demetric J. Dixon, 24, was arrested on preliminary charges of aggravated driving under the influence involving death and leaving the scene of an accident with fatal injuries. Jury members ruled the death of gunshot victim 17-year-old Takai T.J. Creighton on April 23rd as homicidal. Decatur Police Detective Troy Fares said the shooting in the 1400 block of East William Street remains under investigation. Another individual was on the porch with Creighton at the time of the shooting, who witnessed the gunshots coming from a vehicle in the street, according to Fares. Macon County Coroner Michael Day said the boy had injuries to his ribs and internal bleeding that ultimately caused him to die minutes after being shot. The final case heard by the coroner's jury was the June 15th death of Daniel Smith, 46, who collided with another vehicle while on a motorcycle. The cause was ruled accidental after witness testimony indicated that Smith was found to be impaired at the time of his death and had been traveling around 50 miles per hour in a 35-mile-per-hour zone. Cone said the Mount Zion man struck another vehicle that was pulling into the intersection of North Woodford and East Grand Streets about 9:30 p.m. Cone said the other driver had crept out into the intersection slowly due to parked cars along the streets that were obscuring his vision. Day said that Smith had ingested cocaine and marijuana prior to his death and had a blood alcohol level of 0.084. Day said that the cause of death was a skull fracture and brain bleeding. Smith was not wearing a helmet. Our next article is under the heading Editor's Pick, and it's from Stu Ellis. How much and for what? Congress has a big challenge this week and next. Before taking off for its annual vacation in August and returning after Labor Day, the House, Senate, and White House must agree on a final COVID-19 aid package and have it signed. Everyone associated with the task, either in government or on the sidelines, say this is the last chance because Congress will not be thinking about anything other than the election after Labor Day. Agricultural lobbyists are hard at work with virtual meetings, phone calls, texts, emails, and any other communication channels that can reach elected officials. They have skin in the game and know the legislative package is an important carrier of final needs to assist farmers financially hurt by the pandemic. The American Farm Bureau Federation is asking for a hefty $68 billion in the bill that could start to take shape this week. AFBF Executive Director Dale Moore says agriculture has a strong case. We've got a number of men and women across the country, families that simply do not have access to the food that they need, or certainly in the quantities that they need, or they can't afford it because they're out of work. Such funds would be used to fund a USDA's Commodity Credit Corporation. The CCC is authorized to buy, sell, lend, make payments, and engage in other activities for the purpose of increasing production, stabilizing prices, assuring adequate supplies, and facilitating the efficient marketing of agricultural commodities. Its funds have been depleted with payments to farmers earlier this year. Moore says the politics of food is feeding the nation, and that means sustaining farmers, whose markets have disappeared, so that they don't have to destroy the crops that they're raising or the livestock that they're raising. Moore says billions in commodities were already lost from shuttered processing plants and broken supply chains. We've got to closely examine the supply chain and figure out how do we make sure, given all the ability that we have to produce food, that something like COVID-19 or a pandemic situation like we're in does not cause this kind of disruption in the future. He says the American Farm Bureau Federation doesn't have the answer yet, but one is needed. Without it, no amount of money spent for agriculture in a likely final COVID-19 bill will solve the pandemic food supply problem permanently. The $68 billion for the Commodity Credit Corporation, which previously had a $30 billion funding base, would restore the funds and increase that treasury for future disasters and unforeseen circumstances. Senator Charles Grassley of Iowa, chair of the Senate Finance Committee, is not supportive of $68 billion, but says livestock producers who had to destroy millions of hogs and cattle that could not be marketed when packing plants closed need to be reimbursed. We're going to bring that issue up when we bring up the next care package, says Grassley. Grassley will have a significant role in the outcome of the bill, and he's been getting many of those calls, texts, and emails. All the Decatur area obituaries for today. Pending funerals for Wednesday. Hazel Eileen Binion. Hazel Eileen Binion, 79, of Shelbyville, died Tuesday, July 21st, 2020. Howe and Yockey Funeral Home in Shelbyville is handling the arrangements. Mary Hampton. Mary E. Hampton, 83, of Decatur, died Monday, July 20th, 2020. Graceland Fairlawn Funeral Home is handling the arrangements. Ann Kowalsik, 73, of Decatur, died Tuesday, July 21st, 2020. Graceland Fairlawn also is taking care of arrangements. Henry Martin, 85, of Clinton, died Monday, July 20th, 2020. Calvert Funeral Home in Clinton is taking care of arrangements. Glenn Frederick Marksman, 96, of Clinton, died on Monday, July 20th, 2020. Calvert Funeral Home in Maroa is handling those arrangements. Terry Lynn Reed, of Decatur, died Tuesday, July 21st, 2020. Graceland Fairlawn Funeral Home is handling those arrangements. And finally, Toriano White, 47, of Decatur, died Tuesday, July 21st, 2020. And Walker Funeral Service is handling those arrangements. Jimmy Dale Cater, 78, of Macon, passed away peacefully in his sleep on Monday, July 20th, 2020. He planned a private service. Memorials may be made to the Wounded Warrior Project. Tanzius Logan Funeral Care and Service is in charge of the services. Please send condolences to Tanzius Logan Memorial Pages.com. Gary Wayne Hoke, of Clinton. On Saturday, July 18, 2020, at 12 p.m., Gary Hoke of Clinton. His family would like to make a charitable donation to the Lou and Jean Minotti Brain Tumor Institute through Northwestern Memorial Hospital. The family would also like to thank the staff at St. Joseph Hospital. There is no other information available on services. Other deaths listed for Wednesday, July 2020. And in other news, Kanye West files paperwork to get on the Illinois ballot as an independent presidential candidate. Chicago native and world-famous rapper Kanye West filed petitions this week to appear as an independent presidential candidate on the Illinois ballot in November. West's campaign filed 412 sheets with the Illinois Board of Elections on Monday, minutes before the 5 p.m. deadline, in an effort to appear on the November 3rd ballot. Objectors have until 5 p.m. Monday to challenge petitions filed by new party and independent candidates, including West, and none will be guaranteed a spot on the November ballot until it's certified by the Elections Board on August 21st, spokesman Matt Dietrich said. It happens quite often that these new party and independent candidates face challenges, said Dietrich. Due to the pandemic, the signature threshold for independent and new party candidates need to meet in order to be eligible for the ballot is significantly lower than it would be otherwise. 2,500 signatures of registered voters in Illinois. West listed an address in Cody, Wyoming, on his filing petitions. West held his first campaign rally in his bid for president. 14 people are injured in Chicago on the South Side after a shooting. Deputy Superintendent Eric Carter said mourners outside a funeral home were fired upon from a passing SUV. Carter says several targets of the shooting returned fire. The SUV later crashed and the occupants fled in several directions. One person of interest has been taken into custody. Carter says all the victims were adults. The victims were taken by the Chicago Fire Department to nearby hospitals in serious condition. Arnita Getter and Kenneth Hughes said they heard gunshots while in their home watching television, adding that they came outside to find bodies that were shot up and laying everywhere. "We thought it was a war out here," Getter told the Chicago Sun-Times. "It's ridiculous all the shooting that's going on out here. It really has to stop." The shooting comes as the Department of Homeland Security is planning to deploy dozens of federal agents to Chicago to deal with an uptick in violent crime in the city. Chicago Mayor Lori Lightfoot, after threatening to sue if President Donald Trump acted without her permission, said Tuesday the city would be working with federal agents to fight crime. Lightfoot has been skeptical of federal agents being sent to Chicago by Trump due to the controversy in Portland, Oregon, where the Trump administration sent federal officers after weeks of protests there over police brutality and racial injustice that followed the killing of George Floyd in Minneapolis. Lightfoot said she expects Chicago will receive resources that will plug into existing federal agencies that already work with the city, including the FBI, Drug Enforcement Agency, and Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms and Explosives. Oregon's governor and Portland's mayor have expressed anger with the presence of the federal agents, saying that the city's protests had started to ease just as the federal agents started taking action. Trump has framed such protests in the nation's large cities as a failure by liberal Democrats who run them, praised the officers' actions, and said he was looking to send agents to other cities. He pointed to rising gun violence in Chicago, the nation's third largest city, where more than 63 people were shot, 12 fatally, over the weekend. And directly related, facing the agents in Portland, Oregon, the protests have now found new momentum. Marty Weidman has watched protests against racial injustice unfold in her hometown of Portland, Oregon, for more than 7 weeks, but stayed away because, at age 79, she feared contracting the coronavirus. But that calculus changed for Weidman when President Donald Trump sent federal law enforcement agents to the liberal city to quell violent demonstrations, a tactic he said he'll use for other cities. On Monday, a masked Weidman was in the street with more than 1,000 other Portland residents, a far larger crowd than the city had seen in recent days as it entered its eighth week of nightly protests. It's like a dictatorship, Whitman, a grandmother of five said, holding up a sign that read, Grammy says, please, feds, leave Portland. I mean that he can pick on our city mostly because of the way we vote and make an example of it for his base is very frightening, she said. Far from tamping down the unrest, the presence of federal agents, and particularly allegations they have whisked people away in unmarked cars without probable cause, has given new momentum and a new focus to protests that have begun to devolve into smaller, chaotic crowds. The use of federal agents against the will of local officials has also set up the potential for a constitutional crisis, which could escalate if Trump sends federal agents elsewhere. Federal forces were deployed to Portland in early July, and tensions have risen since. On July 11th, a protester was hospitalized with critical injuries after a U.S. Marshals Service officer struck him in the head with a round of less lethal ammunition. Then anger flared again over the weekend after video surfaced of a federal agent hitting a Navy veteran repeatedly with a baton while another agent sprays him in the face with pepper spray. Richard Klein, principal deputy director of the Federal Protective Service, told reporters Tuesday that the officers are part of the Marshals Service and that the Justice Department's Inspector General is investigating. Crowds in Portland had recently numbered fewer than 100 people, but swelled to more than 1,000 over the weekend, and they're once again attracting a broader base in a city that's increasingly outraged. Federal agents again used force to scatter protesters early Tuesday and deployed tear gas and rubber bullets as some banged on the doors of the Mark O. Hatfield Federal Courthouse and tried to pull plywood off the shuttered entryway. The boarded-up courthouse, which has been a focus of protests, is now covered in graffiti. Portland police said some protesters lit fires in the street and tried several times to set them at the courthouse doors. It is time for the Trump troops to go home and focus their attention on other activities, Democratic Governor Kate Brown said on MSNBC. State and local authorities didn't ask for federal help and are awaiting a decision on a lawsuit seeking to restrain the federal agents' actions. Oregon Attorney General Ellen Rosenblum said in court papers that masked federal agents have arrested people on the street far from the courthouse with no probable cause and whisked them away in unmarked cars. The federal government was sued again Tuesday by the Western States Center, two state representatives and others who argued that agents violated protesters' 10th Amendment rights by engaging in police activities designated to local and state governments. Federal agencies defended the actions in Portland. Some in the crowd this weekend used radio frequency jammers and shot pellet and airsoft guns to injure officers, according to the Justice Department. It's also investigating suspicious devices outside the courthouse that could have caused serious harm to those in the building.